is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning and welcome to the Cool Project Show on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Michelle Molyneux, and with us today we have the lovely Diane Fitzgerald, National Director of RPM Foundation at the LeMay America's Car Museum in Tacoma, Washington. Diane, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
I'm so excited to have you with us. One of the things I wanted to, first of all, let's talk about your background and how did you become the National Director of the RPM Foundation?
Well, lucky enough, I was in the right place at the right time, I guess is what the real answer is. And the longer answer is I applied for the position when I heard it had become available after working at LeMay America's Car Museum for 2 years in membership, and was interviewed and got the position, which I started in September of 2014. The role had been around since 2005, and the first and only other person who had been in this role had retired. And so I was I'm the second national director of the RPM Foundation.
Now, it wasn't called RPM Foundation originally, so what was the history about that?
Well, there are a history of quite a few names, and the names reflect not uncertainty, but the evolution of it in the marketplace and the good work of the entity. It was founded in 2005 by Hagerty Insurance in Traverse City, Michigan, and it was called the Hagerty Fund for a short period of time, changed into, renamed and rebranded into the Collectors Foundation for most of 2006 through 2012, 2013. In 2013, the Board of Directors of the Collectors Foundation and the Board of Directors of LeMay America's Car Museum decided to merge, and therefore a name change was discussed and agreed upon, and we became the Hagerty Education Program at America's Car Museum. And then, which I've been heading up for almost 2 years now, as I said before. And one of the things that we looked at strategically in Q4 of 2015 was what direction we were going in. We analyzed this pretty strategically, and we decided that it needed to be renamed to reflect more of everybody, mm-hmm. as opposed to a branding name of one entity, the founder. We wanted to make it an everybody's foundation. So RPM stands for Restoration, Preservation, Mentorship, and it completely reflects what we're doing and what our donors want to engage in meaningfully, which we really appreciate. Plus, RPM with Revolutions Per Minute has the car and boat, I guess, mm-hmm. affiliation, which, of course, is important. Wow. So we are now, as of June 1st, 2016, we have just been renamed, and we're launching actually on June 6th, tomorrow, RPM Foundation into the marketplace, and we're pretty excited about it.
Great, and it's so wonderful that we have you here to talk about this new launch as well.
Thank you.
Before we talk a little bit more about the RPM program, let's talk about you, because you're a very, very dynamic person, and you have an incredible background. So let's talk about your background, and because you have quite diverse interests and passion about cars and motorcycles.
Yeah. Actually, motorcycles first, probably, and then cars. But I'll rewind the tape and let you know that I'm the oldest of four girls, and we didn't have a car guy dad. But my first boyfriend was a car guy, and he bought and restored old cars, plus bought exotic cars at the time. And in 1971, he had a Mustang Mach 1, and we were in a parking lot one day trying to teach me how to drive a stick shift, which failed miserably because a Mach 1 is like a race car and everything's very stiff, and you have to know how the subtlety of changing gears feels, and it just wasn't working. So sometime shortly thereafter, I bought an old beat-up Volkswagen Beetle, which was squishy, and it didn't matter if you grinded the gears, and you weren't going to shoot off like a bat out of hell if you got the gear thing wrong. And so I learned how to drive a stick shift, and I'm not exactly sure why I felt I needed to drive a stick shift. It's kind of funny because in the 1950s, I was born in the 1950s, and in the 1950s there was a big shift, no pun intended, from the manual transmissions of the 40s and early 50s into automatic and encouraging women to drive, which then gets you into the social revolution kind of stuff going on in the 60s. And automatic cars were important to people. And yet, for some reason, again, I don't know why, I felt an urgency to learn how to drive a stick shift. It ended up being one of the smartest, luckiest decisions ever, because when I became a motorcyclist, it was very easy to change or to adapt that stick shift of cars to the hand shifting on a motorcycle with ease. And I've also been in situations, especially in world travels, where automatic transmissions are not normal for rental cars, and it's manual transmissions. Anyway, so all the way back then, I was dating a car guy, and I seem to have a pattern of dating car guys along the way and motorcyclists somehow. And I married one, and we are collectors. We collect vintage microcars, which are cars that were using, or the manufacturers were using, motorcycle engines adaptively in cars, small cars, after World War II to remobilize Europe and devastated Japan to get people mobile again. They didn't need driver's licenses because the so it was kind of an interesting, genius of technology kind of thing. And we also buy and restore a lot of Italian cafe racer motorcycles, but we also right now have a big collection of Eastern European scooters. And again, the focus is on technology and to a certain extent design and, you know, the solution of how to mobilize people. We love that. So my husband and I are very into cars and motorcycles. We're members of clubs. We organize world meets. We organize regional meets. We write newsletter stories. We take pictures and send them in. And, you know, we're very engaged in the community of enthusiasts. And we've been involved with LeMay America's Car Museum since 2002, before there was even a hole in the ground. The building opened in 2012, the building that you were in this weekend. So we had been involved as the first non-Tacoma, Washington board members invited to be on the board and the steering committee in 2002, and have remained donors, major donors of the museum, and committed to our automotive heritage through the education programs of LeMay America's Car Museum. And as luck would have it, I applied for a job in 2012, was in charge of membership, and then a higher level of membership after that, and applied for this position, and am in heaven because it is the best job I could ever imagine. And what the job is to identify around the United States and in Canada young people who are the next generation of craftspeople taking care of our old cars. And it's something that I call young people and old cars, the future of restoration. And it's not as simple as just finding the kids. It's finding the high school teachers that go above and beyond the call of duty, the colleges, community colleges, junior colleges that have automotive restoration programs, which are few, but they are, we're stimulating the inclusion of automotive restoration programs, piggybacking with auto tech programs at different schools, and working with shops and collectors. You know, the pipeline of, there are jobs out there as the older generation is retiring, there are jobs available, and the demand is not nearly equal to the supply. The supply is very, very small. So we're trying to stimulate the supply side of that equation by finding the kids, encouraging, letting them know that this career in automotive restoration and preservation exists, and then doing whatever we can to help them with the formal education pipeline to get to shop readiness to be employable at restoration shops around the United States.
So we'll talk more in detail about this program as well in the next segment. But how many do you have, like, numbers when it comes to getting people into the auto restoration? Is the space expanding or is it shrinking?
No, the space is definitely expanding. And what's expanding? So there is a need. There's a demand for workers as people are retiring, and the demand is for craftspeople, not auto mechanics. And the educational pipeline is expanding to allow newcomers into the educational force, or the educational pipeline, as I call it. But what we have to do continuously is inform people at the 16, 17-year-old and their guidance counselors that this is a feasible, relevant, elegant, good-paying job option and a career path.
Right. And you don't have to get like a big degree. It's a lot cheaper, or is it?
Yep. Well, there are a couple of different approaches depending on what you and your family need. The couple of different approaches are a certificate program, which would take weeks, maybe 16 weeks. A degree program of varying sorts. There are two-year colleges that have two-year degrees, which are Associate of Applied Science degrees in automotive restoration. There's one school in the United States that has a four-year Bachelor of Science degree in automotive restoration technology, and that's McPherson College in McPherson, Kansas, almost right in the middle of the state of Kansas. And a stellar two-year program at Pennsylvania College of Technology, which is an affiliate school of Penn State in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. They've got the Applied Associate's degree, or the Associate's Applied Science degree. You can add on to that, if you're liking it well enough, 2 years of business to get an Applied Management degree in automotive restoration shop management. And so they customize if you wanted to do some continuing education. There are some schools across the country, Central Carolina College, that has an open enrollment. And if you're already working at a shop, but you need more extensive education in, say, TIG welding, you can go to this school and get a very intensive, precise course in that. So it's just almost like a continuing education approach. Mm-hmm. People don't have to go to college to get into this field, but there are people who decide to go to college because it's like getting an art degree. It's in automotive restoration, but these are not grease monkeys. These are the craftsmen who are taking care of classic cars. Classic cars are from the beginning of time, horseless carriages in the 1880s through what we're tracking right now as being 1981. But, you know, we know that there are cars from the 1990s that are pretty soon going to be classic cars as well. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, when a car is restored and the owner of the car has to figure out what they're restoring for, whether it's to drive safely or to show in car shows and add value to the car by winning and adding on credentials, the owner of a car needs to figure out what they're going to do with the car. And more times than not, when it is restored, it is a better car than the car that came off of the assembly line back in the day, because the materials are stronger, lighter, thinner, more pliable. A lot of things technologically from a material standpoint change from the time that the car was made to the present. So there's an adaptation of materials to restore something, but that's all part of the decision-making process, which is pretty interesting.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
So coming up, we'll talk more with Diane and the newly launched RPM Foundation after we get some few words from our sponsors.
Buzz off with Lawyer Liz. Join me each week, Wednesdays at 2 o'clock, as we talk drones, Internet of Things, and technology.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on americaswebradio.com.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Cool Project Show. And today with us, we have Diane Fitzgerald, whose passion is preserving America's automotive heritage and the interests of the collector car and motorcycle community. Diane, just before the break, we were actually talking about the students and education. And is it imperative that they actually have to have that degree, per se, to get into auto restoration? What are your thoughts on that?
They definitely do not. There are a lot of menu options out there for them, including a four-year degree, as we said before, at McPherson College, which is a 40-year-old program, restoration program, and the Harvard of automotive restoration, to be sure. People who go to school there, who have been there for 4 years, get exposed to a lot across the country in the collector car industry, including auctions, concours, d'elegance, which are car shows that are judged by serious judges, a little bit like Olympics. There are more casual car shows, other car events, buying and selling, not necessarily at auctions, but the secondary market of sales is another very viable part of the collector car industry, as is collector car. Classic car centers are now being developed by the OEMs, the original equipment manufacturers like Porsche, Volkswagen. I just learned this weekend that BMW, so the European OEMs, are building classic car centers here in the United States with an eye towards having parts from all of their warehouses be available, because parts is one of the hardest things to find when you're doing a restoration project. So getting organized about the parts. Anyway, there are a lot of roles that someone can have in automotive restoration. Even in the actual restoration process, there are a lot of different roles. You can be an expert in electric, you could be an expert in upholstery, under the hood with mechanics, bodywork. You could be the expert on the provenance of the car before you start a restoration project. You've got to know what you're dealing with, because it's a serious investment for the owner to do a restoration project. But back to the education, there are very talented high school students who may need one or two coursework from a local college just to get more experience with a certain aspect of restoration, like TIG welding is what I had said before, but they don't necessarily have the appetite for a 2 or 4 year school. They want to go right into the workforce, and there are shops that are ready to hire them, but they do have to have basic skills. So there's a funny thing that happened in our culture, and that is that in the old days, in the 50s and 60s, when people were, when cars engines were different before the 80s, so this is the 50s, 60s, and 70s, people were working on their cars. People would fix things. We've become a throw-it-away kind of a culture, or just replace it kind of a culture. But back in the day, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, people were working on their cars with their grandfathers, with their dads. And at 12 years old, you know, if you're doing that since you're 12 and now you're 19 years old, you've got 7 years of under-the-hood experience from Saturdays and Sundays and summer vacations, and you have a certain degree of non-formal training that make you shop-ready. But that doesn't happen anymore. So what has happened is the discipline of automotive restoration is now something, just like art history or just like law, is a discipline that you aspire to learn because you think you might be interested in it. So now it's the post-secondary and in some cases secondary vocational schools' obligation to develop curriculum that kind of makes up for those 7 years that other generations had under the hood as kids with their grandfathers and fathers and mothers. So the formal education pipeline looks very different from what it had looked like in the old days. That said, okay, so it's different, and so now we're dealing with it, and we're trying to figure out how to get kids into the pipeline. Mm-hmm. We certainly know that there are thousands of kids out there who are interested in it. In 2015, I traveled 57,000 miles around the United States looking for school programs, the car guy kids, the high school car lovers, the parents who were supportive, the administrators who were supportive of looking at automotive restoration as an additional curriculum to their auto tech programs, and we've been making good progress with that. In 2015, the Academy of Art University in San Francisco, as an art school, introduced automotive restoration as part of their art program because they're looking at the art of the car and approaching restoration from that standpoint. Back in the day, 40 years ago, McPherson College added automotive restoration on top of their auto tech program as a way, because they saw all the old cars that were coming in, as a way to acknowledge the future of jobs, the potential of jobs, and the feasibility of careers over some period of time. So it's been an interesting, in my opinion, it's been a very interesting 15 years, and the visionary of McPherson, you know, we always kind of look back at that as an educational genius for having come up with this. But, you know, guidance counselors just don't know that this is a career path. Well-educated parents sometimes are reluctant to have their children become grease monkeys, but I'm the first one to tell them that I was an art major in college, and I got really messy in ceramics class, and I got really messy in sculpture class, and art is elegant. And this is that same thing. You get messy, but there's an elegance to it. And this is preserving our automotive heritage, and this is very, you know, people who are interested in automotive restoration or in classic cars have an ounce of historic passion in them. They're very interested in history. So the beginning place is there, a curiosity about the history of technology, the history of mobility, the history of our economy as we know it today is completely because of cars. And people who are interested in old cars typically come to it because of that fascination. And to then be able to support these kids who are interested in it, and the way that RPM Foundation supports kids is we award through a grant process scholarships. We also award schools some program money for equipment and materials, but more times than not, we're really funding the scholarships. But we love seeing projects getting done, and so we will award projects as well. And that's a little bit of what we do. I would say 25% of what we do is grant making, and 75% of what we do is service providing and resource sharing. So we try to take away the roadblocks for kids who are interested in this, take away the roadblocks of distraction or financial barrier or whatever to prevent them from coming into the field. We try to take those roadblocks away. We try to help the shop owners. We try to help the kids. We try to bring all these people together. And we certainly try to create community in an effort for community leaders and people who are going to benefit from these educated kids to be able to come together and have a voice in the shaping of curriculum. It's pretty cool stuff.
That's really amazing. And so right now, part of your role is actually expanding that network with organizations who are willing to take in some of these kids for training, or...
Yeah, so not all shops are the right kind of shops for a mentoring situation. But that said, I would say more shops than not that I talk to understand that that educational pipeline has changed from when they were growing up and they had the experiences at 12 years old under the hood, and that they now have to be involved in the formal education process. And so what we've created are internships and apprenticeships with some of these shops, and the mindset that, you know, this, these students are not necessarily going to be able to take over that piece of automotive restoration before 2 years from now, and that you, Mr. Shop Owner, signs on for being part of that formal education because our education process has shifted over the years. And it shifted mainly because, for two things, in my opinion. The shift in cars comes from a change from one kind of engine or car operating system to another, where now cars are computerized, and with computerization comes the beginning of replacement, not repair. And the second thing is computer technology in general, and we believed in the 70s and 80s that our economy was going to be fully technologic, and what people forgot was that we're not going to ship our cars to China to get repaired. And if we're coveting our first Mustang from the 1960s, and now we're saying, you know, it's the 2000s. We need to repair our car because most of us drive our cars. We drive our classic cars. You know, they're not, we think of them as art, but they're not precious art that we can't touch. Mm-hmm. We engage in use and activities, just like I said at the beginning of this interview. So we now need to get those craftsmen in the pipeline, and we're doing it, but the shop owners need to participate, and they are willingly, with being mentors and helping to make their future business a success.
How do you get them to become aware of the program?
The shop owners,
yeah.
57,000 miles in 2015 helps.
You know, a lot of travel for you.
This is a perfect example of a business model that's the happy blend of low-tech and high-tech. And the low-tech piece is getting on a plane, going somewhere, scheduling meetings, talking to people, and meeting with them, telling them the stories of the kids that we're finding. A lot of people, I've been myth-busting over this past year and a half, almost 2 years. A lot of people, shop owners in particular, think that there's no one out there. And I am here, no one out there in the next generation who's ready to, and maybe they may not be shop ready, but they do have the passion. And so I am, I think, making these shop owners realize with confidence that there are a lot of kids out there. And like I said earlier, the guidance counselors, one of my missions for 2017, and I actually think I'm going to start doing it in 2016, maybe Q3 or Q4, is to start whispering in the ear of guidance counselors and getting in front of them. There's got to be a guidance counselor association somewhere or several somewheres that I can go and talk and say, you may not know this, but, and start engaging in conversation with them so that they can start spreading the word. So the shops get to know us because I'm traveling a lot and going to them, and because the word has been spread in that community, like I'm trying to with the guidance counselors to the school communities. And it's, you know, that happy blend, like I said, happy blend of low-tech and high-tech, of doing normal engagement with people, engaging them in this movement, because I really think of it as a movement, mm-hmm. and engaging them in their local community, in addition to the bigger community. So some of these shops are taking apprentices and interns from other parts of the country, not their zip code, not their own zip code. So I'm trying to spread the word about mobility, you know, that this can be done. We are helping kids explore housing when they've got an opportunity out of their own home zip code. And helping them with housing doesn't mean giving them money for it, but, you know, they may not have ever lived somewhere before, so just getting them to think straight about how you find housing. And you don't need an apartment. You need a room in someone's house or subletting a college, you know, dormitory, or, you know, there are ways.
Yeah.
So we're helping on the soft side of things as well as the educational path, which is the hard skills.
Right. Well, coming right back, we'll talk more about this program and the students and some of your projects as well. We'll be right back.
When four members of Congress all die within 4 months, each of their deaths appears to be from natural causes. But when mysterious messages begin to appear in the form of quotations from long-dead revolutionary heroes, one reporter sets out to prove the existence of a serial killer. His search discovers dark secrets and an assassin shielded by people who need the very services that only he can provide. The Sun Silas Rising, a novel by Doug Dahlgren, on Kindle or paperback through Amazon.com.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Cool Project Show. We have Diane Fitzgerald from the RPM Foundation, which is located in Tacoma, Washington, but Diane is actually located in Chicago. Before the break, we were talking about this three-car road trip, and we were about to talk about going into the Chicago. So tell us a little bit more about that.
So the drive home is what the event was called. It was a 3,000-mile, 11-stop drive from Tacoma, Washington to Detroit, the purpose of it was to acknowledge the impact of technology that Detroit gave us vis-a-vis the automotive industry. And January 9th is the beginning of the Detroit Auto Show, and so the drive was timed to include arriving at the auto show when it started. But the Chicago stop was hosted at our personal collector car garage, and the three iconic cars came in and parked in our spanky new garage. And we had 100 guests there, including some of our grant awardees in the Chicagoland area. We give grants everywhere around the United States to schools and to students. And we happened to have two high schools represented at the Drive Home Chicago reception. And interestingly, Lyons Township High School in particular made a big impact on all of the guests that day. Mm-hmm. Turns out that several of their students through the RPM Foundation network have gotten summer employment. So this was in January, and we had a couple of site visits and collection tours and interviews. And this is a case where we didn't give anybody money. We just gave them access to our network and to connecting dots, making doors open. So three of the students from Lyons Township High School, as I understand it right now, have summer employment at several collections in the Chicagoland area as juniors going into senior in high school, which is the perfect kind of upstream attention to work and experiences that will get these kids, you know, by the time they graduate from high school, they may have had two summers plus maybe sometimes during the year of working at a shop as an intern. And, the decision then to go on to college or continuing formal education, you know, by doing this upstream, they get more and more experiences to get to be closer to shop ready. And I couldn't be more thrilled to be able to have connected some of those dots. Some of my adventures, have been, aside from RPM Foundation, have been over the years, my husband and I owned and operated an international motorcycle touring company. And our world has gotten vaster, not only because we were taking people on motorcycle vacations to Bhutan and Brazil and Mongolia and Tuscany and the Alps, but we met people along the way. And we are in clubs, you know, car clubs and motorcycle clubs with these people. We attend events all around the world with them. Our network is vast. So that when we get to be in a situation of working, impacting the next generation of craftsmen, we are at the ready to be able to call in on not necessarily favors, but just, again, connecting the dots. Do you know anyone who? And can you help us with this? And so the real momentum to the movement has come from just this low-tech, high-tech blend of getting out there, spreading the word, believing passionately in heritage and in the next generation, and knowing that there are kids there ready, willing, and able to be exposed to this, even as a consideration for a career. Mm-hmm. So we have, I said before, part of what we do is give grants, and we go through a grant-giving process. It would be great if we could just give money away to anybody, but that's not the way the real world works. We have a board of directors, and they are generous of spirit, but fiscally responsible to the organization, and so deliberate on each of the grants that are submitted to us. We've got three grant cycles during the course of the year, and institutions can apply any number of times that they want. They're not limited to one time only. And they apply based on when they need the money from a cash flow standpoint for scholarships or programs. We have a personal preference for dealing with institutions, and in some cases that means museums as well, and other automotive entities. But we have just recently started giving gap funding, is what we call it, to individuals, and have an individual application process as well as an institutional application process, which is really simple. In the overall scheme of applying for money, it's a lot easier than getting money at a bank, and it's certainly a lot easier than submitting a grant application from the government. It's a 2 or 3 page questions with backup information requested, an opportunity to use 2 pages as they wish to tell the story, hopefully with pictures. We love photos and captions because they tell great stories. and they tell, you know, 1,000 words. Mm-hmm. References, people that we can call, and they submit a grant 3 times a year, and we deliberate and announce our grants. In the case of people who are denied grants, which happens, and people who have gotten grants in the past don't necessarily guarantee get them again. But what we do is we offer grant support. And so anyone who is a first-time grant applicant can ask for support. Anyone who was denied very typically will come back and ask for information to understand the denial process and what can they do to strengthen the probability of getting grants in the future. Now, my colleague Pam Dudley and I are not in a position of decision-making. We're the messengers. It's the RPM Foundation Board of Directors who makes all the decisions. But we are very happy to, knowing the history of how we fund it, knowing what our future strategic focus is, we're very happy to give however many hours of grant support we can. Short of writing the grant for someone, we'll edit it, we'll look at a draft and have opinions, mm-hmm. and we want people to win and be part of this whole movement. I have to say, though, some of the greatest impact that we've had, aside from money, which is a good thing,
yeah.
is the community building that we've been doing.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I want to give the example of our May 4th summit meeting in Mesa, Arizona. This has to do tie in with grants. The superintendent of a vocational high school that's fed by 10 community high schools in the Mesa, Arizona area submitted a grant about a year ago, and it was denied because the grant was requesting funding for a modern auto tech program that would prepare, it was equipment, but it would prepare people for jobs at dealerships, and we don't fund that. We fund restoration. But I noticed in the application that she said that they had 200 of their 5,000 students, because they have hospitality and culinary and radio stations and all vocations. 200 of their 5,000 students were auto tech students. And I know the law of large numbers to be that if there are 200 auto tech kids, 20 of them or 15 of them have got to be car guys, have got to be high school car lovers. And sure enough, I stayed in touch with the superintendent and her teaching staff to the point of hosting them at very significant car events and activities in the Phoenix, Scottsdale, Mesa area, to the point of the superintendent saying to me sometime after the fact, after we're cultivating a relationship, you know, I think we should explore adding automotive restoration to our curriculum.
Oh, fantastic.
We just have to make sure that it's market relevant. And I said, why don't we have a summit meeting? So in about 5 weeks from when she said that to May 4th, we got 60 people from 12 states together, including shop owners and collection managers and collectors and other schools and the colleges. We had 3 colleges on site, McPherson College coming and talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly of automotive restoration curriculum and curriculum development, Pennsylvania College of Technology, and the Academy of Art University in San Francisco, all of whom had various insights that would help the school more efficiently get to the end game of automotive restoration and bypassing the mistakes that people have made along the way. We also had a shop owner or a shop manager and one of his colleagues, who was a Hagerty Education Program scholar in Pennsylvania, now living and working in Dallas. So the shop manager, Randy Bush, and Ryan Levesque is our HEP, what we call our HEP ambassador, now it would be RPM ambassador, who is now fully employed there. And we had some guest speakers, like Lynn St. James, of course, who spoke eloquently about inspiration and passion and focusing on an end game. And it was the most amazing 5.5 hours. At the end of the summit meeting, which was very carefully designed in terms of the conversation, we had an open mic session where every one of the attendees could offer an opinion or insight or ask a question. And at the end, we asked the superintendent, now that you see there's interest in the marketplace, the local marketplace and the national marketplace, What would it take for you to start an automotive restoration program? And she said, only two things. I've got the money. The only two things that we would need are an advisory committee and a teacher. And I said, well that's pretty easy. So I started soliciting people of the participants who would volunteer right then and there to be on the advisory committee. And 14 people signed up, two of whom are out-of-towners, Randy Bush from Dallas and my husband, Burt Richmond, who's a RPM Foundation ambassador in Chicago. Everyone else was a shop owner or a collector or a museum owner in the Scottsdale, Phoenix, Mesa area. And they've started working on a job description, and the hope is to include, when school resumes on August 15th, an elective to start with, and then roll out a full certificate program over the next 18 months or 2 years. So it was a complete home run in terms of being able to influence curriculum development in that area. And the PS is, we never gave that school any money.
Wow.
But the point is, we are building community there, and we hosted the co-hosted with the school the summit meeting. It was awesome. It was just fantastic. So there's the grant part of the world of what we do, and that's really important, but it's not the only thing we do. We stimulate and inspire and are the gateway to other opportunities, both for shops coming upstream to get talent and for students going downstream for jobs. So it's pretty cool project.
That's a very cool project. I love the play on the words. So they do now have an auto restoration program there?
Well, this was just May 4th. June 5th?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're making it happen.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's absolutely amazing. I think we need to have at least 10 of those in each state.
Well, that becomes a template for other locations that's easy enough to replicate. I mean, it's turnkey now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the biggest thing is getting the people there. And the number of people at 60 was completely perfect. Many of the speakers were not professional speakers, so the room was not overfilled with a crowd that was intimidating. But it was like a town meeting, and it was very productive and lively, and the lunch was awesome. The food was prepared by the culinary school, so it was made by the students and served by the students, so we were surrounded by it. Oh, and I should have said that while we adults were meeting on the topic of automotive restoration curriculum, we had two local collectors bringing their cars, an 1898 Jean Perrin vis-a-vis French horseless carriage, and a 1903 Mitchell, both which were performance cars of the day,
right,
and a motorcycle, so that all the 200 auto tech students were out being informed and inspired by the local collectors. So we have this dual parallel world going on.
Right. And we'll be right back.
Watchdog is a term given an organization like the United States Justice Foundation, which since 1979 has been watching out and, when necessary, taking the appropriate action, from testifying to litigating to protect our constitutional rights. USJF, a nonprofit organization, is nationally recognized not only as a watchdog, but many in the government, as well as those involved in legal cases, have also called the USJF a bulldog for the tenacious approach in their presentation and proof of what is right. Find out more at www.usjf.net. Support USJF as they support you.
Buzz Off with Lawyer Liz. Join me each week, Wednesdays at 2 o'clock, as we talk drones, Internet of Things, and technology.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Cool Project Show. We have Diane Fitzgerald from the RPM Foundation, which is located in Tacoma, Washington, but Diane is actually located in Chicago. Before the break, we were talking about this road trip.
So the drive home is what the event was called. It was 3,000-mile, 11-stop drive from Tacoma, Washington to Detroit. The purpose of it was to acknowledge the impact of technology that Detroit gave us vis-a-vis the automotive industry. And January 9th is the beginning of the Detroit Auto Show. And so the drive was timed to include arriving at the auto show when it started. But the Chicago stop was hosted at our personal collector car garage. And the three iconic cars came in and parked in our spanky new garage. And we had 100 guests there, including some of our grant awardees in the Chicagoland area. We give grants everywhere around the United States to schools and to students. And we happen to have two high schools represented at the Drive Home Chicago reception. And interestingly, Lyons Township High School in particular made a big impact on all of the guests that day. Mm-hmm. Turns out that several of their students through the RPM Foundation network have gotten summer employment. So this was in January, and we had a couple of site visits and collection tours and interviews. You know, this is a case where we didn't give anybody money. We just gave them access to our network and to, you know, connecting dots, making doors open. So three of the students from Lyons Township High School, as I understand it right now, have summer employment at several collections in the Chicagoland area as juniors going into senior and high school, which is the perfect kind of upstream attention to work and experiences that will get these kids, you know, by the time they graduate from high school, they may have had two summers plus maybe sometimes during the year of working at a shop as an intern. And, you know, the decision then to go on to college or continuing formal education, you know, by doing this upstream, they get more and more experiences to get to be closer to shop ready. Some of my adventures have been, aside from RPM Foundation, have been over the years. My husband and I owned and operated an international motorcycle touring company. And our world has gotten vaster, not only because we were taking people on motorcycle vacations to Bhutan and Brazil and Mongolia and Tuscany and the Alps, but we met people along the way, and we are in clubs, you know, car clubs and motorcycle clubs with these people. We attend events all around the world with them. Our network is vast, so that when we get to be in a situation of working, impacting the next generation of craftsmen, we are at the ready to be able to call in on not necessarily favors, but just, again, connecting the dots. Do you know anyone who? And can you help us with this? And so the real momentum to the movement has come from just this low-tech, high-tech blend of getting out there, spreading the word, believing passionately in heritage and in the next generation, and knowing that there are kids there ready, willing, and able to be exposed to this, even as a consideration for a career. We go through a grant-giving process. It would be great if we could just give money away to anybody, but that's not the way the real world works. We have a board of directors, and they are generous of spirit, but fiscally responsible to the organization, and so deliberate on each of the grants that are submitted to us. We've got three grant cycles during the course of the year, and institutions can apply any number of times that they want. They're not limited to one time only. And they apply based on when they need the money from a cash flow standpoint for scholarships or programs. We have a personal preference for dealing with institutions, and in some cases that means museums as well, and other automotive entities. But we have just recently started giving gap funding, is what we call it, to individuals, and have an individual application process as well as an institutional application process, which is really simple. It's a 2 or 3 page questions with backup information requested, an opportunity to use 2 pages as they wish to tell the story, hopefully with pictures. We love photos and captions because they tell great stories. And, you know, references, people that we can call, and they submit a grant 3 times a year, and we deliberate and announce our grants. In the case of people who are denied grants, which happens, and people who have gotten grants in the past, don't necessarily guarantee get them again. But what we do is we offer grant support. And so anyone who is a first-time grant applicant can ask for support. Anyone who was denied very typically will come back and ask for information to understand the denial process and what can they do to strengthen the probability of getting grants in the future. Now, my colleague Pam Dudley and I are not in a position of decision-making. We're the messengers. It's the RPM Foundation Board of Directors who makes all the decisions. But we are very happy to, knowing the history of how we fund it, knowing what our future strategic focus is, we're very happy to give however many hours of grant support we can, short of writing the grant for someone. Mm-hmm. And we want people to win and be part of this whole movement. I have to say, though, some of the greatest impact that we've had, aside from money, which is a good thing, is the community building that we've been doing.
Oh, and absolutely,
I want to give the example of our May 4th summit meeting in Mesa, Arizona. This has to do, tie in with grants. The superintendent of a vocational high school that's fed by 10 community high schools in the Mesa, Arizona area submitted a grant about a year ago, and it was denied because the grant was requesting funding for a modern auto tech program that would prepare, it was equipment, but it would prepare people for jobs at dealerships, and we don't fund that. We fund restoration. But I noticed in the application that she said that they had 5,000 students because they have all vocations. 200 of their 5,000 students were auto tech students. And I know the law of large numbers to be that if there are 200 auto tech kids, 20 of them or 15 of them have got to be car guys, have got to be high school car lovers. And sure enough, I stayed in touch with the superintendent and her teaching staff, to the point of hosting them at very significant car events and activities in the Phoenix, Scottsdale, Mesa area, to the point of the superintendent saying to me, you know, I think we should explore adding automotive restoration to our curriculum.
Oh, fantastic.
We just have to make sure that it's market relevant. And I said, why don't we have a summit meeting? So in about 5 weeks from when she said that to May 4th, we got 60 people from 12 states together, including shop owners and collection managers and collectors. And we had three colleges on site. McPherson College coming and talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly of automotive restoration curriculum and curriculum development. Pennsylvania College of Technology and the Academy of Art University in San Francisco, all of whom had various insights that would help the school more efficiently get to the end game of automotive restoration and bypassing the mistakes that people have made along the way. We also had a shop owner or a shop manager and one of his colleagues who was a Hagerty Education Program scholar in Pennsylvania, now living and working in Dallas. So the shop manager, Randy Bush, and Ryan Levesque is our HEP, what we call our HEP ambassador, now it would be RPM ambassador. And we had some guest speakers like Lynn St. James, of course, who spoke eloquently about inspiration and passion and focusing on an end game. And it was the most amazing 5.5 hours. At the end of the summit meeting, we had an open mic session where every one of the attendees could offer an opinion or insight or ask a question. And at the end, we asked the superintendent, now that you see there's interest in the marketplace, the local marketplace and the national marketplace, what would it take for you to start an automotive restoration program? And she said, only two things. I've got the money. The only two things that we would need are an advisory committee and a teacher. And I said, well that's pretty easy. So I started soliciting people of the participants who would volunteer right then and there to be on the advisory committee. And 14 people signed up, two of whom are out-of-towners, Randy Bush from Dallas and my husband, Bert Richmond, who's a RPM Foundation ambassador in Chicago. Everyone else was a shop owner or a collector or a museum owner in the Scottsdale, Phoenix, Mesa area. And they've started working on a job description, and the hope is to include, when school resumes on August 15th, an elective to start with, and then roll out a full certificate program over the next 18 months or 2 years. So it was a complete home run in terms of being able to influence curriculum development in that area. And the PS is, we never gave that school any money.
Wow.
But the point is, we were building community there, and we hosted the co-hosted with the school the summit meeting. It was awesome. There's the grant part of the world of what we do, and that's really important, but it's not the only thing we do. We stimulate and inspire and are the gateway to other opportunities, both for shops coming upstream to get talent and for students going downstream for jobs. So it's a pretty cool project.
That's a very cool project. I love the play on the words.
That becomes a template for other locations that's easy enough to replicate. I mean, it's turnkey now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the biggest thing is getting the people there. And the number of people at 60 was completely perfect. Many of the speakers were not professional speakers, so the room was not overfilled with a crowd that was intimidating. But it was like a town meeting, and it was very productive and lively. And oh, and I should have said that while we adults were meeting on the topic of automotive restoration curriculum, we had two local collectors bringing their cars, an 1898 Jean Perrin vis-a-vis French horseless carriage, and a 1903 Mitchell, both which were performance cars of the day,
right,
and a motorcycle, so that all the 200 auto tech students were out being informed and inspired by the local collectors. So we have this dual parallel world going on.
Right. Well, Diane, can you believe it? We've come to the end of the show. I want to thank you. You've inspired me. I'm hoping you've inspired everyone who's listening in. What you're doing is admirable. Getting more kids involved in auto restoration and boat restoration. We didn't even talk about that.
Oh, right.
But you also do
vintage classic boat, wooden boat restoration. Oh, yeah, we do it in a big way. Probably 10% of what we do is devoted to classic boats.
Exactly. So how does people get a hold of you?
So people can get a hold of me, Diane Fitzgerald. I'm the National Director of RPM Foundation. And as a reminder, RPM stands for Restoration Preservation Mentorship. You can reach out to me via email. My email address is diane@rpm.foundation. And you can also reach out to Pam Dudley, who is our administrative coordinator, who is responsible for grants administration and the school's relationships. And the direct toll-free number in Tacoma is 855-537-4579. Our website, www.rpm.foundation. It's a new extension for URLs.
Diane, thank you very much. If anyone wants to get a hold of me at the Cool Project Show, you can also email me at coolprojects@americaswebradio. I will also be posting this interview and lots of images on the coolprojects.com website. Thank you for listening, everyone, and have a fantastic day. Bye-bye for now.
This is americaswebradio.com. The best in chat radio, designed just for you.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose, and with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.